This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today we have with us in the studio Port Townsend poet Linda Robertson. Linda learned to love poetry through listening to her mother's recitations of Tennyson, Wordsworth, and Frost during San Diego beach walks. She has lived in Washington State for over 30 years. While raising a young family in the remote Methow Valley in the North Cascades, she completed several University of Washington distance learning classes in poetry. She has been on a poetry journey ever since. In 2011, at the age of 56, she entered Chatham University's Low Residency MFA program, a unique writing program with emphasis on nature, environment, and travel writing. Linda continues to write poems, attend workshops and literary festivals, and travel. For a week in August 2016, she lived and wrote with Irish and American poets at Annam Cara Writers and Artists Retreat on the Barra Peninsula in Ireland. She has just recently returned to the Pacific Northwest from England in Galway, Ireland's week-long international festival of literature. She continues to revise and expand her master's thesis, a manuscript called The Missing, and hopes to publish it one day, and I'm going to add soon. Thank you for being here, Linda.
Thank you for having me.
It is exciting for me because as someone who walks with you and talks with you often and knows your poetry, I envy you your life in poetry. There's not a second of the day, I don't think, that you're not feeling your poetic soul and just thriving on it. So I did see as I was reading your bio that the word poetry is capitalized. And I thought maybe you had a reason for that. What does poetry mean to you?
I capitalized it that way because finally, now it's an emphasis of mine. It's a priority. Whereas before, as I was raising a young family, home-based business, living out in the country, it was kind of a hobby. And I would write as much as I could when I could. But it wasn't something that I could really focus a lot of time and energy and money. But now I'm in this part of my life, and this is my journey, my road that I'm on.
So when you first started and you were taking your distance learning classes, was that still a time when it wasn't easy to write a lot?
Right. I had about a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old. Yeah. And so it was hard, but it gave me that assignment that I'd have to write every week. And I had somebody who was waiting on the other end for me to send my work in. The poet that was my teacher was Christiane Bach. She was wonderful because when she would send my poem back through the mail, this was before internet and all that, she would write on it, but then she would also send a little cassette tape. And she would be sitting at her desk in her office, and she'd say, "Hi, Linda, I love the letter that you sent with your poem. It's so great to hear about what the weather's been like or what your life is, what's going on in your life." She would talk about my poem, but then she'd say, "Have you ever read Mary Oliver, or have you ever come across these poets?" And I hadn't really, because I was really pretty isolated where I was. There were no universities anywhere close to where I was living. And that was wonderful. It was just such a window for me. And she really opened the life for me in many, many ways.
I think that when you're devoted to poetry, both as a teacher and as a student, that's what happens, because we care about it so much. Mm-hmm. And it's lovely to listen to you talk about writing a poet who you didn't know letters and sending your work over distances. And the internet is totally wonderful. I totally love it. To share poetry is so easy. To find poetry is so easy. But there's just something so beautiful about imagining you sitting there writing and imagine her sitting there taping and writing and corresponding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain that, but maybe we'll have to write poems about that.
Yeah. She ended up coming to the Valley after a while, and she had a new book out, and she came and read, and I had a chance to meet her in person, which was wonderful.
Full circle.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
Yes.
So the other thing I noticed in reading your bio was that your writing program had an emphasis on nature, environment, and travel writing, which sounds like perfect for you because, of course, you lived close to nature in the isolated place you lived in the Methow environment. And I know enough about you to know that you travel. So did you select that program because of its emphasis?
Yep, I did. Yeah, I had not really considered a program at all. And I was at the time of my life where empty nest, my life was changing a lot. I knew there were big changes ahead of me. I started a subscription to Poets and Writers magazine, and I opened it up, and it opened up to this page. It said Chatham University's low residency program, and said that about nature, environment, and travel writing. And I thought, oh, that's perfect for me. So I contacted them and ended up applying, and never looked back.
Sounds like you were perfect for them. So that's what I call synchronicity, which is so alive when you're writing. Mm-hmm. It just seems that when I'm writing, things seem to fall into my lap or my attention. Mm-hmm. When I'm busy with my to-do list, not so much.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
How about you read one of your poems to us?
Okay, I thought I'd just start by reading just a few short poems that were actually fairly new, that were written for a project that I did with local photographer Michael McKee, who gave me a selection of probably 20 photographs of Port Townsend and asked me if I would respond to them in some way with these poems. And we'd had a show up at Pippa's Tea House last year, and I thought I'd just read a couple of those. So one was, these are just called, they're glimpses, kind of these photographs. Morning wakes to blue air, blue ice, blue fog. Even our breath is sea-hued. Mew gulls call across the pale hours as tide waters forsake the faithful shore. Then here's another one. This might be the road home or a way to the edge of a world, yours or mine. Low clouds hold back cedars welcoming the briefest sky. Among red alder and scattered green, mule deer wear rain, their hides dark as loam.
Thank you. Okay. Do you have another one from that series?
Sure. So this one was a photograph of a pier with these big storm waves attacking it. Storm. A winged disturbance, a dissonance, a blue tumult, a clamor, a chill-bladed passion of violence.
Do I see another one in front of you that's also from that series?
Oh, there's more, but...
One more.
Okay. As the timid sun plummets into the sea, rain-swamped dusk disappears down Water Street. Lights in every window, cedar green, red as tulips, star flash, kindle us home.
I feel like you have certainly written from place and used some extraordinary verbs. The one about the water in the, when the tide was low, was that maybe the first poem you read? Maybe you could share that phrase again.
Let's see, the mew gulls call across the pale hours as tide waters forsake the faithful shore.
Yes, forsake the faithful shore. Yeah. It's such a beautiful way to describe what goes on every day and what goes on as the tide recedes. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Sounds like his photographs were very stirring, too.
Yeah, and I found through my writing program, I had an opportunity to expand some interests that I had, and one of them was ekphrastic writing. And I ended up doing an independent project, which I called Gaze. And it was while I was traveling back and forth between the Mettow Valley and London, where my daughter lives. And I really like writing about visual art as in response to visual art and sculpture. And yeah.
They're very inspiring for you. The poems, though, create that world really dynamically. I felt like I was very at home in each one of these poems, although I wouldn't have thought that way. I wouldn't have thought forsaken the shore, for instance, or that the animals wear the rain. Lovely.
Thank you.
And I woke up to an intense fog this morning. So, I get one beautifully sunny day. And if you live near Discovery Bay, as we both do, that often leads to intense fog.
That's right.
It was like, what season is this? I felt when we woke up. So speaking of seasons and place, you lived a long time in the Mettow Valley, Eastern Washington, and now here you are having chosen Western Washington. Do they both feed your poetry?
Definitely.
I know I'm putting you on the spot to ask you this, but do you think that something in the contrast between the two landscapes is energizing for you?
I think so, and I think that I lived so long and wrote so many poems about the Mettow, and it was really kind of refreshing in a way to change the environment and then see what happens with my work. And I think my work is definitely changed because the environment's changed, but also my life is much different. So it's kind of just all of that, you know, it's complicated that way.
It's good.
But I find that things that I pay attention to, you know, I write in Ireland, and those poems are a little bit different than the poems that I'm writing in Port Townsend or the ones that I wrote in downtown London, you know, urban areas versus...
So you really sink into place.
I do.
And yeah. Is that something that's just inherent for you, or did you learn anything about that in the travel writing emphasis?
No, I think that's just my nature. I think that is my nature, yeah.
Did you happen to bring poems from overseas that you wrote overseas?
Well, I did, actually. Two of the poems that I wrote from Ireland last year, I could share with you. So I went last year for 3 weeks to Ireland. I traveled by myself for 2 weeks from Dublin and then down to Kilkenny and over to Cork and then up finally to the Barra Peninsula, where I spent a week, as you said, at a writer's retreat and got the incredible privilege of spending a week with Irish and some American writers and living with them and having breakfast and then writing with them. It was just wonderful. So this first one was before the retreat. It's called A Pilgrim's Way, Kilkenny. One swan seeks the river's edge. A broad path follows the leafed sky. I turn to cross a soft field beneath unfamiliar clouds. Always a trail before me as I travel alone. Thankful for hedges of fuchsia that bloom, illustrating their season. If there is light in this world beyond our sun, they offer it. I rest against a ruined chapel wall, lean into its certain charity.
And that's something you wrote while you were there.
Mm-hmm. Started there. Mm-hmm. And then this next one was quite personal. When I was in the retreat, we went out and kind of field trips every day, got to see the area. And one day, the poet Leanne O'Sullivan, who led our retreat, took us up to the Alahis Mine, which is an old copper mine up on this beautiful mountain that overlooks the sea. And it was quite troubling, the history, because the village down below, the boys at 14 would begin to work the mines. And this was in the early 1800s. They'd go down with candles, and it was below sea level, and so many were lost. Just the day before I left to go on that trip, I found out that my brother and somebody who I love deeply was diagnosed with an early dementia or brain problems. So we were given the assignment after visiting the mine to somehow write impressions of it or use it in a poem in some way, and this came to me. It's called A Letter from the Alahis Mine, Barra, for Tommy. For 40 years you lived the sea, salt wind, a well-provisioned boat, sails taut with sun. You memorized the name and job of every part, jib halyard, stanchion and lifeline, keel and anchor. You learned to read charts, to find your way with a compass. This was before your drifting. Now words are lost to the currents, and the sky is damp with last year's tears, though you hardly notice. I stand above wind-worn sea on Irish hills shrouded with heather and stone. Here, men mined the green earth for copper, delved deeply towards its center, gouged its soul for wages. The hand-hewn clefts are scarred with tales of candles snuffed by breathless depths, of saints and whiskey, of heartbreak and ruined health. Brother, where are you going? I think of you slipping down a shaft of forgetting, and like men lost to those caves, hundreds of meters below seabed, you too crushed by darkness, without light enough to find a way out.
Must have been hard to be there and hear this news.
Yeah.
And also quite wonderful because you could have an instant way of processing it.
Mm-hmm.
The image of the mind, that's another piece of synchronicity. And I think the way our emotions, when we're writing, choose the images. I mean, you did have this assignment, but on the other hand, you chose, as mm-hmm. a poet, mm-hmm. the light, the shaft, the everything that could help you metaphorically talk about what's so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is speaking with Port Townsend poet and Methow Valley transplant Linda Robertson about coming to poetry in an isolated location and her current writing and dedication.
Well, maybe before I ask you this, do you have one written from downtown London? Do you have something to compare? You said that your poems are different depending where you're writing from.
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to look it up really quick.
You're very organized here. An index.
This is my thesis.
But you're adding to it all the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But lots of poems. So when I went to London, my daughter was living in Hackney, and I stayed with her for 2 months. And the first morning I woke up, I looked down in this courtyard. She lived in a mews, and this is what I wrote after looking down. It's called Number 2 Orchard Mews, Hackney, London. 5 a.m. Saturday, a rustling of foxes unwinds me from the hour, loosens the seams of shoddy sleep. I watch the foxes deft foraging in the courtyard. One excavates near the Royal Prince William Rose, another savages a bag of chips. Two, younger I think, mount a slick blue tarp that conceals the rubbish bins. Round and round they bound as if it was a frozen pond. This morning I would like to slip from my second story ledge, to scavenge alongside these four foxes, to mark their brick and mortared world, slink beneath the siren's screech, eavesdrop the walled-in voices. We might stalk a careless calico, fluster pigeons off fog-breathy ground. But I stay, finger the newly cracked window as the sun bends day's corner, as the foxes bolt towards another burrow, as the neighbor's cat braves the musky stillness, as the clock chides, stranger, alone.
You still found nature.
Yeah.
Foxes, the cat. But what a wonderful way of coming to how you felt alone. And so alone that you would join the foxes but didn't.
Yeah.
What are the lessons, life lessons, that poetry's taught you?
To tell the truth, to dig deep, read. One of the professors at Chatham, Laurie Jaquila, said to us during a lecture, writers should be looking for and creating luminous moments. Mm. And I think those are some of the things that I really tried to hold, as well as, it's funny, you know, how when you have different workshops or mentors and someone says something and it just stays with you forever. One of the things that happened to me in 2006, I was down at Fish Trap in Oregon, and I had the privilege of working with Luis Alberto Araya, and he said to us the first day, first thing, writers build bridges, not borders. Mm. And I think so much of my work is about connecting kind of the outside world to the inside world, and about the past to present and people.
That's a wonderful statement to remember. And I like knowing it, now I can remember it. What does it mean in your life outside of poetry that poetry keeps you focused on the luminous moments and on telling the truth and on digging deep? I've heard it described that a poet is someone who lives at the edge of her nerves, or his nerves. And we have so many ways of trying to explain to the world at large what it means to be a poet. And I think it does impact our, I'm going to put this in quotes, normal life. Mm-hmm. Because for us, what we consider normal and what other people consider normal might be different. But how do you think it impacts the ability to connect outside of writing, the ability to hear truths and tell truths?
I think what kind of comes to mind to me is Billy Collins said, poetry is the prayer of attention. And I think that that's one of the things that you learn as a writer and as a poet, is that you just learn to pay attention to things. And I think that that just helps informs who you are.
Give us a little snapshot of your day, and just how do you find yourself paying attention?
Well, I love walking. And I think I'm always out looking for birds and trees and light, and I reflecting on my life, and so that, and writing. And I don't have much of a routine right now because I have elderly, or you know, had elderly parents who have required a lot of help and care, and I've been coming back and forth down to San Diego and back, and then my daughter's living along, so I don't know. Can't give you much of a formula for my life.
Well, that's okay. Yeah. But what you're saying is wherever you are, you're paying attention.
Mm-hmm.
Do you follow the advice of some writers to keep a notebook? Do you actually jot down what you have seen?
Absolutely. I always have a notebook with me. I have a small pocket notebook. I mean, now I use my phone to write notes. My phone is full of notes. But yeah, I've kind of one of those writers who, if I'm struck with a kind of an image, it becomes a poem. And so I have lots of notebooks of that. Yeah. And word banks. I'm a real believer in word banking. So when I used to like go hiking in the North Cascades or even wherever I am, if I'm on a train in London, I just start writing down colors, snippets of conversation, just everything I can think of, everything I'm seeing outside. And those will find their way into poems for sure.
So because you review them or because they're just with you?
They're just with me, yeah.
So the writing just sort of, the writing them down mm-hmm. reinforces mm-hmm. the memory bank of them. But mm-hmm. it's not like you go pouring through, or do you go pouring through your notes and go, ah, there's a word?
Not so much, but sometimes I'll go back. Like if I'm trying to revise a work, I'll want to go back and see where it started, mm-hmm. what those seeds were.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, one thing I notice in your poetry is that there's not very much explaining. The fuchsia color that has more light as if it's from beyond our sun. All these absolute specific details mm-hmm. bring you to the inner world, the like what you call the connecting, to the processing, to the longing. I know for me, in my learning from poets, coming from East Coast and East Coast poetry to the Northwest mm-hmm. was interesting because I had to learn to stay specific mm-hmm. to imagery. It wasn't my natural state, having read different kind of poetry there. And yet it's what I've learned is its value, that I almost can't write without details.
Right. Yeah, my teachers always said, when I was in my program, always said I was a very visual writer.
So it was already in you to mm-hmm. be that way, and mm-hmm. then poetry was perfect venue.
Mm-hmm.
What was your life before poetry in terms of artistic expression?
When I had children and all that, I loved being with my kids. I think that was my creative.
Yeah, but what were you doing?
Oh, I was a stay-at-home mom pretty much, but we had a home-based business as well, so I did the books and things with that. We had 30 acres. There was just lots to do, and I did lots of volunteering, yeah. living in a small town. The classes needed volunteers, and I felt always really lucky, and I loved being in with the kids.
So when I said, what were you doing, I meant with the kids. Were you doing art? Were you doing photography?
Oh, no, once the teachers found out that I had an interest in poetry, uh-huh. they very eagerly handed it off to me.
Did your kids start writing?
Yes, my kids both started writing, yeah. Yep, they did. One of the things that happened when I started taking those distance learning classes is I found out, maybe through Christiane, about writing workshops that happened throughout the United States and beyond that were week-long. With some encouragement from some of members of my family and stuff, I started going every so often, you know, once every 4 years or something, I would go. And those prompts and the things that I would learn, I was so happy to take those back into the classroom and share with the kids. As best I could, you know. Uh-huh.
Did some of that writing culminate in some collections for the community?
Yeah. Yeah, we would always try. Whenever I was in a classroom, I would always try to create some kind of a little pamphlet or something that the kids would. Painting the Sky was one of them. I mean, you know, we would just have them, the third grade, sixth grade, seventh grade. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah.
You've done a lot of good work.
Oh, thank you.
It's a privilege to talk to you. And then, to feel how privileged you feel to be able to be further exploring the world of poetry. It doesn't stop, does it?
No, it's forever.
Yeah. Right. So you have some new discoveries in terms of poets you're reading?
Really, when I was in my program, that was such an eye-opener for me because I had one class that was required was readings in poetry. And I think that class we had to read 14 collections every page and such different writing. People I never would probably have, some of them never picked up off of the bookshelves. And that really was instructive, I think. And also, you know, the instructions from our professors would say, when you read a whole book of Sylvia Plath or D.A. Powell or somebody, what are they doing and how do they do it? And those were such great questions and really kind of got you read with a little bit different eye mm-hmm. and really go deep, read deeply.
One of my favorite books about writing poetry is John Ciardi's How a Poem Means.
Mm.
And it changes how you, whether you're a poet or not a poet, mm-hmm. it changes what you come to poetry for and what you bring from it. And I know that most of us, when we studied poetry in school and then in college, we weren't really taught how a poem means. We were taught what the teachers wanted us mm-hmm. to think about, which was motif and themes and all that. And I know, and you probably agree, that that's not what we sit down with as poets. Mm-mm. What do we sit down with? Can you even articulate what you said? An image
yeah.
become, you know, a poem is going to come from an image that's really struck you. Mm-hmm. So you come, first of all, with that image somewhere in your heart and mind. And then what happens?
I would never probably write anything that didn't have some kind of an emotional quality. I do a lot of free write. I'll do a free writing. I always try to remember beginner's mind. Every time I start a poem or face a page, don't be afraid, just write. And then it kind of goes from there and starts taking shape. And maybe it'll take a while for me to kind of figure out what this poem is really about.
Mm-hmm. That's how it should be, I think. If
yeah.
you sit down thinking you know what it's about, then you're never going to get to
no.
what it wants to be.
Right, right.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, I think that we do have time for you to read another poem if you would like to.
I think I might read this one. This is it's a draft. It's fairly very new, but it's something new for me. It's a kind of a resistance poem. I'm starting to really write, thinking about more really what so much is going on outside of just my little world. I read some wonderful work by Adrienne Rich. So this is called Times Like These, after Adrienne Rich. And there's an epigraph that's part of a poem of hers. Our country moving closer to its own truth and dread, its own ways of making people disappear. Times like these. Slender alders grown their own truths. Green leaves will drop and wither. Gray barked trunks will crack deeply, scar. Some in the thicket will slump against another. Some will fall. Beneath ordinary stars, an unquiet mind is flogged by words. Muslim, ban, families fractured, six prayerful gunned in a mosque. Dream drought, sleepless. In the blue-black hours, I listen to cedars gathered. They're wearing out the wind with their close-grained hearts.
Mm. Well, once again, you've turned to nature to help you explore something that's man-made.
Mm-hmm.
All this drama and emotion, and instead of building bridges, building walls.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. If you were going to talk to readers of poetry, what would you ask them to bring to their reading of poetry?
I would say stay open and sit with the words and in quiet, and take the time to really read and to reread and to read a poem aloud.
Mm. And if you were going to talk to people who are wanting to write poetry, what would you leave them with?
Get started. Don't
That's
wait.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Linda. Thanks for being here with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Sheila.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.